Thief is an ugly word. Paul Gallico. If one were to take a pencil and, upon a stereographic projection of a world map, execute a series of straight lines connecting New York, Munich, and Buenos Aires, one would find oneself looking at a large isosceles triangle, the points of which are at such a distance from one another that they might seem to preclude the coincidences of a certain day early in January of 1944. However, since this is not a mathematical treatise beyond the simple arithmetic of Mr. Augustus A. Swinney, an American refrigeration engineer whose life's philosophy could be summed up in the inescapable verity that 2 and 2 add up to 4, we are less concerned with a geometric shape than the shape and pattern of the events that took place at those widely separated points. For instance, take the functioning of two gentlemen of similar general titles, one in Munich and the other in New York, Herr Professor Hildebrand Bressart and Mr. Curtis Henry. Mr. Curtis Henry was active on the American Commission for Salvage and Protection of Art and Historic Monuments in Europe. His opposite number, Professor Bressart, operated under the beautiful title of
Kunstverwaltungsrat für arisch-europäische Altertumskultur,
which, literally translated, means Art Custodian Advisor for Aryan European Ancient Culture. Boiling their work down to the very essence of its nature, Curtis Henry might be termed an art detective engaged in ferreting out the hundreds of thousands of objects of art pilfered throughout Europe by the Germans, with the eventual objective of returning them to their original owners. Professor Bressart, for all his wing-collar dignity and high position as curator of the Pinakothek in Munich, was nothing more than a kind of superfence engaged in the disposal of same. Being merely a good Third Reich German and lacking, like most such good Germans, the moral and ethical probity of a cherry-stone clam, it would have been difficult to make the professor understand that what he was doing was wrong. But we are interested in Herr Bressart only because of his ill-concealed satisfaction at the dawning of that certain day in January, illuminated as any particular day of international villainy always is to a German by being thought of as Der Tag. In fact, that is what Herr Professor Bressart's assistant called it when he greeted him with,
"Good morning, Herr Kunstverwaltungsrat. This is the day, is it not?"
"Jawohl, Herr Reinecker, today. I have had a cable from Buenos Aires."
"Ah, then they arrived? Everything goes well?"
Professor Bressart consulted a cablegram on his desk and then shifted his gaze to certain lists of items before he smiled and replied,
"There is nothing that can go wrong. A member of the Argentine government is the sponsor. The Americans remain stupid and asleep, and besides, they dare not interfere in Argentina. And human greed remains what it has always been. Think of what it means, Reinecker. Millions of dollar credits for the party."
And he rubbed his hands. Herr Reinecker licked his lips. Mr. Curtis Henry's brief connection with this story is that some 3,000 miles away in his office at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, he was taking the deposition and claim of a Dutch refugee, a chubby, shabby-looking little man with the face of a careworn child by the name of Jan van Schuven. He gave his address, one of the Lower West Side, which confirmed the tale of penury and reduced circumstances hinted at by his clothes. "And the art object to which you wish to lay claim," said Curtis Henry, his pen posed over the blank he was filling in,
"Se old woman of Harlem, by Rembrandt van Rijn,"
said van Schuven simply. Henry put down his pen and whistled. "Great heavens! You're that, van Schuven?"
"I was,"
replied van Schuven, with such simple dignity that all the questions Henry had been forming were stifled, and he confined himself to the questions on the information blank. "Family?"
"My wife is with me. She is ill."
Some memory of misery and hatred flared in the Dutchman's placid eyes for a moment. A somber flash of indignities suffered.
"My son is in the English flying. My daughter is a nurse, also in England."
"Value of the picture?"
It would bring between $300,000 and $350,000 today.
Henry had a sudden insight into what such a sum would mean to a once wealthy merchant who had obviously suffered complete ruin at the hands of the Germans. He read the next line, "Proof of ownership," and then checked himself, but Van Schuven chose to reply.
"The picture has been in our family for generations. I believe your expert, Mr. Chester Allen Buskirk, knows."
Curtis Henry made a nose at the mention of one of America's foremost art critics and experts.
Mr. Buskirk is a little too internationally art-conscious for us. The world recognizes the picture as your property."
He completed the form and then turned to the little refugee again.
Look here, Herr Van Schuven. I'm sorry, but you realize, of course, that at present we can do no more than list these properties and the whereabouts of their rightful claimants. There is very little chance of their being recovered for a considerable period. Even after the Germans have been defeated, we..."
Van Schuven rose and bowed.
"Thank you. I realize that. As a refugee honored with a home in your great country, I only felt it my duty to assist you in your work. Some day the time will come."
The thing was happening in his eyes again. Then it faded. He bowed again, put on his shabby hat, and went out. It was on that same day, at the end of the third leg of the triangle, 5,300 airline miles from New York, that Mr. Augustus Swinney was attending a cocktail party in Buenos Aires. From the first, Mr. Swinney had found himself fascinated by the intricacies of the diplomatic niceties, the frozen faces and the delicately balanced situations of a gathering under the sponsorship of a neutral nation. Representatives of belligerent, semi-belligerent, and neutral countries were collected uncomfortably under the same roof, munched at the same buffet table, from carefully studied positions, in which well-tailored but chilly backs formed impregnable circles, or gathered in tight, unassailable little groups in various corners of the two brightly lighted and ornate salons given over to the guests, opening the ranks only to admit one whose nationality or politics fitted them into that particular group. Thus the Germans remained a hard core, hard-headed, hard-shirted, dark-suited, immediately beneath the splendid crystal chandelier suspended over the center of the inner room where the buffet table was located. Bright, feminine bits of silk drifted toward the dark core, swirled, floated away. Small, dark Argentines, distinguished by their dark eyes and English clothes, revolved around the rim. The solid Prussian center never changed or moved. The British contingent, semi-official and obviously on hand to see what was in the wind, managed to achieve a bland unawareness of the enemy by rallying beneath an excellent Romney hanging in the outer room, a gloomy portrait of the Duchess of Colchester gazing down dispassionately at her countrymen forming their own tight little aisle in the swirl of humanity, brought out by the exhibition of a new art treasure acquired by Alfonso de Paraná, Argentine millionaire and collector, and sponsored officially by the gray, frosty, super-correct person of Dr. José Calderiega, sub-minister of culture of the Argentine Republic. The British were bounded on the north by the Russians, who, looking as though they had slept in their clothes, held together a kind of lumpy and disheveled front, and on the south by a small satellite island of correct and careful Swiss. A small group of Americans, thoroughly ill at ease, remained close to the door for immediate escape in the event of any total loss of social composure. Italians and French drifted, disconsolate and homeless, unable to create any nucleus that satisfied them. In spite of strong rocks of nationalism, the party was kept fluid by the circulating movement of lovely women of indeterminate allegiance, and the many glowing-eyed men whose allegiance was plainly and simply to the lovely women. Mr. Swinney, free American citizen, cosmopolite, due to his world wanderings as refrigeration engineer and expert for Swift & Co., the meat packers, unhindered by the social quavers that gripped other members of the American colony, drifted, moved, searched, came and went as he pleased, shouldering his tall, lean figure through the crush of uneasy celebrants. He went everywhere, talking, chatting, listening with his skin as well as with his ears, and avoiding only the existence and perimeter of the dark, ugly core of Nazis, whose presence stank in his nostrils. That 2 and 2 added up to 4 he was still quite certain, but of the real purpose behind this curious yet brilliant gathering he was not at all sure, beyond that it was for the ostensible occasion of viewing a painting, a canvas of sufficient importance to cause the Argentine sub-minister of culture to spread the grey mantle of his sponsorship over the affair. It was only because of his semi-official diplomatic mantle that such an extraordinarily mixed group was able to attend. It was also, Mr. Swinney knew quite well, because of the quasi-government sponsorship that social barriers were down, to him as well as 3/4 of those in the room. Most of those present would otherwise never have been permitted to set foot in so much as the anteroom of the home of Signor Alfonso de Paraná, one of the wealthiest men in the Argentine and a social figure of importance in Buenos Aires and Paris. The guest list apparently represented a cross-section of the wealth, diplomacy, industry, and international society of Buenos Aires. Mr. Swinney was not unaware why he, in particular, had been invited, since, holding the important position of chief refrigeration engineer for Swift & Co., the meatpackers, he did belong to the upper stratum of industry. He was also able to reason that since art is generally accepted as an international commodity, this might well account for the international nature of the gathering. But since Mr. Swinney was also well aware, as was everyone else present, that their host, de Paraná, was an ardent Argentine fascist, a supporter of fascist government policy and an enemy of the United Nations, he was alive with curiosity as to the real reasons underlying the gathering. Where allies and fascists met across the front lines, they shot at one another. Here they mingled and circulated, sipping champagne and nibbling delicacies. It was Mr. Swinney's first experience of the grand diplomatic and social lie that covered human behavior under such circumstances, a lie that was acted out daily in Turkey before it swung to the side of the Allies, in Portugal, in Switzerland, in Buenos Aires. Mortal enemies met, rubbed shoulders, passed, pretended they were not there. As a cultured American businessman in his early 40s, a man at home in 5 languages and most of the European capitals, this curiously childish kind of pretending amused rather than outraged Mr. Swinney. It was the presence of a second lie that aroused his curiosity and vaguely disturbed him. He wondered whether the canvas hanging behind the closed doors of de Paraná's fabulous library, not yet thrown open to the guests, was actually, as rumored, Rembrandt's famous Old Woman of Harlem. He doubted it. And yet, that was just it. No one had said that this was the picture they had been invited to see, and yet everyone seemed to know. No one said anything, and everyone knew everything. How the Germans were bringing goods into the Argentine, how quinine was being diverted from Bolivia and sent into Germany via Franco-Spain, how secret information about a British meat convoy found its way into the hands of the commander of a Nazi submarine wolf pack, how even perhaps a Dutch art treasure might conceivably turn up in Buenos Aires, the Paris of South America. Once one was careful to maintain the fiction of Argentine neutrality, one seemed to pick up information and knowledge by osmosis, through the pores of the skin. Someone might say casually, "I understand that," and the vague rumor understood would be closer to the truth than the news printed in the controlled press. Mr. Swinney's sane, precise mathematical mind explored and sifted rumor and personalities in an attempt to reduce them to simple denominators such as 2 and 2, which could then be added up to 4, the gray, icily proper Dr. Calderiega, conversing with the British commercial attaché Fat de Paraná, his small nostrils twitching, his dark eyes gleaming sensually above the grey pouches that underlined them, fingering a small, priceless Cellini group and discussing it with a famous French sculptor now resident in Buenos Aires. The tawny, monocled, correct Baron von Schleuder of the German embassy staff, holding a thin-stemmed, gold-speckled Venetian champagne glass between his stubby fingers and exchanging polite small talk with the wife of an Argentine cattle king. Damn it, it was all so official and correct. Mathematics and the consequences of the addition of simple sums were driven from the mind of Mr. Swinney when he again caught sight of the magnificent woman with the upswept Titian bronze hair and cat eyes. She was standing in the inner salon not far from the buffet table, conversing with the paunchy little fuss budget of a man with the rimless eyeglasses, the gay 90s stiff collar, and the obvious toupee. God, she's good looking, Mr. Swinney said to himself. I wonder who she is. He had seen her twice before, once during the noon corso on the Avenida Florida, and again in the American bar of the Hotel Continental at cocktail time. Mr. Swinney was a bachelor by choice, but this did not prevent him from becoming profoundly stirred by certain types of women. Women with cat eyes and the mysterious, introspective, feline expression of countenance that went with them, he found irresistible. He edged through the throng and, entering the second salon, moved closer. He busied himself at the buffet table and watched her out of the corner of his eye. No doubt that her clothes had originally come from Paris. Only the French knew how to reveal a classic figure in daytime dress. The daring of the purple hat perched atop the thick, bronze-colored hair fascinated him. By Jove, she had the skin to carry it. The set of her head on her neck was a challenge to every man in the room. Mr. Swinney noticed other eyes upon her. He determined to meet the challenge in his own way. She and Fuss Budget appeared to know each other well. If he could become acquainted with the fat little man with the toupee. De Parana suddenly appeared and joined the two, claiming the girl. Swinney hoped that he would name Fuss Budget, but he didn't. He said,
Forgive me for robbing you, my dear friend. It is only for an instant. I swear I will return the Countess to you in a few moments.
Fuss Budget's head waggled archly at the top of his stiff collar, and he bowed and turned to the buffet table, loaded with the delicacies of five continents. Mr. Swinney contrived to be next to him. Mr. Swinney was surprised to note that Fuss Budget did not smell of mothballs as he had expected, for he was a small, self-sufficient leftover from another era, the professional gentleman of the old school, and obviously an epicure. He tasted the gray Malasol caviar and nibbled at Hungarian pâté, savoring texture and flavor. But the full expression of his ecstasy he reserved for the paper-thin, near-transparent slices of smoked, fuchsia-colored ham. He tasted. He chewed. He swallowed. He closed his eyes with reminiscent delight. When he opened them, it was to find a tall, spare gentleman with a craggy hawk-like face, long, strong nose and dark hair, sprinkled with gray at the sides, eating of the same ham and smiling at him sympathetically.
By Jove, said Fuss Budget. Genuine Westphalian ham, perfectly cured.
Delicious, said Mr. Swinney.
The little man polished his glasses with a scented silk handkerchief, replaced them, examined the old dark red ham from which the slices came, and helped himself to another portion.
Haven't tasted a real one for years. Don't know why they can get it here and we can't up in New York.
Mr. Swinney could have told him. It was one of the things that one knew by osmosis again when one lived in Buenos Aires. It was small in bulk, like so many other of the German products that one could always find in Buenos Aires stores. The Leica cameras, the fine lenses and optical goods, the rare drugs and medicines labeled IG Farben Berlin. But he was not of the mind to alarm or astonish the little man, but rather to make friends with him.
The secret lies in the process of smoking. Have you ever tried one of our old Argentine hams? We have our own process of aging and curing. The hams are first soaked in wine for weeks.
The little man's ears cocked like a terrier's and his nostrils flared.
Really? You mean better than...
Tenderer. The flavor is unique. They are never exported.
Fussbudget licked his lips, then glanced at Mr. Swinney.
But, you are an American, are you not?
I am with Swift and Company. I should be delighted sometime if you would care to sample.
The man sighed regretfully.
Unfortunately, I am flying back in the morning.
Then he added importantly,
I flew down only yesterday at the invitation of Dr. Calderiega. It would really be a new taste experience. Of course, there is no question as to the superiority of Argentine beef.
Mr. Swinney was thinking to himself,
Now who the devil could you be? Flew down from New York at the invitation of the Argentine sub-minister of culture. I suppose I ought to know you, but I don't.
De Paraná returned with the cat-eyed girl on his arm and returned her to Fussbudget.
Voilà, mon ami, as I promised.
The little man bowed in the manner of one careful not to disturb the set of a toupee. For an instant they made a little group of which Swinney was the outsider. Fussbudget hastened to perform the politeness. He said to Mr. Swinney,
I did not catch your name, sir.
Swinney, Augustus Swinney.
Of course, Countess Amelie, may I present Mr. Augustus Swinney? The Countess Amelie Chernock. You know De Paraná, of course.
The Countess Amelie gave Mr. Swinney her wide cat smile and accepted him with her eyes. He was startled to find them violet-colored, the shade of her hat. Later, when they were alone, he said,
I schemed to meet you. Are you angry?
She spoke with an accent that might have been French.
Not at all. I saw you scheming. That is why I came back. It is always flattering to a woman when she sees an attractive man make up his mind to meet her.
Mr. Swinney made a mental note.
Aha, then she was watching. I wonder whether she noticed me in the Continental.
He said,
I intruded myself shamelessly upon the little man. By the way, who is he?
That is Mr. Buskirk, the art critic. Surely you know Mr. Chester Allen Buskirk? I met him many years ago in Paris. He is so sweet and old-fashioned.
Buskirk. Buskirk, the art critic, greatest living expert on the old masters. Flown down from New York to Buenos Aires at the invitation of Dr. José Calderiega. Now what did that add up to if one was still convinced that in spite of the super-impeccability of congealed diplomatic face, 2 and 2 made 4?
You are French, Countess?
Part French, part Polish.
A combination that inevitably results in a beautiful woman.
You look like an American, but you do not talk like one. Have you been to Paris, too?
Before he could reply, there was a sudden stir in the room, a kind of mass awareness of a change in the routine and the beginning of a movement through the second salon toward the massive carved oak doors leading to the library. The doors which previously had been shut were now swung back. The Countess Amelie drew in her breath and sighed,
Ah, the picture. Now we are permitted to see the picture. Are you not excited?
You mean Rembrandt's Old Woman of Harlem?
Then you heard too.
One hears a great many things. I don't believe it.
You do not believe it?
In the light from the crystal chandelier overhead, her eyes were wide and luminous.
But why should it not be possible?
Because, said Mr. Swinney flatly, they wouldn't dare.
But he found out when he came into the library and saw what hung on the wall of Brazilian teak wood paneling, that they did dare, after all, that 2 and 2 still added up to 4, and 4 made a very ugly number. In Munich, Kunstverwaltungsrat Bressart was burning the lights late in his office in the Pinakothek, poring over lists marked Final Shipment Following Liquidation, Krakow Museum, Krakow Occupied Poland, and occasionally earmarking items for the Argentine. In New York, Jan van Schuven, the little Dutchman with the tired child expression and the desperate eyes, stood in the dingy hall outside the dingy furnished room and listened to the doctor say,
Madame van Schuven is a little better tonight. However, if it were at all possible, I would say it was almost imperative that she be moved to a warmer climate, at least for a time.
and in a tiny cove just outside Avellaneda, some 25 miles south of Buenos Aires on the Rio de la Plata, an impatient U-boat captain sat in the steel cell of his quarters, reading over a 3 weeks-old copy of the Völkische Beobachter, digesting for the 10th time the accounts of the Wehrmacht's glorious advances to the rear in Russia, and wondering how long it would be before the orders came through from the embassy in Buenos Aires to unload his cargo, pick up the return load of tungsten, molybdenum, platinum, and quinine, and put to sea. He was tired, anyway, of being a damned freighter. There was no knight's cross with oak leaves for that kind of work. Mr. Augustus Swinney looked up at Rembrandt's magnificent and touching masterpiece, The Old Woman of Harlem, beautifully hung on the paneled wall of de Perana's fabulous library near the 15th-century Spanish fireplace, softly and glowingly lit to bring out all the deep warmth of the tones of gold and brown. He thought of the first time that he had gazed on its breathtaking perfection. It had been in Amsterdam, he remembered, in 1938. He had dined at the home of a business acquaintance, Mynheer Jan van Schuven, a wealthy tobacco merchant with plantations in Sumatra. They had been discussing the possibility of the use of refrigeration for the preservation of tobacco in transit over long distances. Van Schuven lived in a timber house in Amsterdam that was 400 years old. After the evening repast, Frau van Schuven and her young son and daughter excused themselves and retired. The tobacco grower had led Mr. Swinney to the library to drink Javanese coffee, smoke the strong black cigars of twisted Sumatran tobacco, and inhale the fragrance of a brandy that was laid down the year Wellington cornered Napoleon at Waterloo, not far to the south. The ceiling timbers of the room were of blackened oak, the deep chairs of oak and leather. Candlelight shone on soft pewter and the glistening leather backs of old books. Many candles illuminated the glowing, lifelike portrait of a wrinkled old woman in a heavy, carved gold frame that hung casually on the wall opposite the beamed fireplace, where its surface would catch the reflection of the curling, colored tongues of driftwood flame. Mr. Swinney had not been able to take his eyes from it. Not only the portrait fascinated him, but the concept of its hanging. It was displayed not as an art treasure, but as a part of the warm, richly somber decoration of the old room, as an object, Mr. Swinney felt, that had occupied its place for a long, long time. To van Schuven, he said finally, indicating the portrait, "How that lives! How warm and kindly it makes this room!" Van Schuven nodded, drawing on his black cigar until the end glowed.
"It is called The Old Woman of Harlem. My ancestor, Piet van Schuven, received it from Rembrandt in payment of a debt. Piet made for Rembrandt a pair of Leiden boots of Spanish leather. It is so registered in his account book."
Van Schuven smiled his placid Dutch smile.
"The story is told that my ancestor considered himself ill-used in the exchange. The leather cost him 11 florins.
That evening had always remained in Mr. Swinney's memory as a kind of island of deep peace and the ancient culture of living, standing out brightly in the turbulent streams of his travels. The Germans had brought fire and flame and their new order to Amsterdam. Now the old woman of Harlem gazed down at him with her wise, aged eyes, peering out from beneath the white wimple from the paneled wall of another library in Buenos Aires. The heavy 2-foot-square gold frame was a different one, but there was no mistaking the picture. To have seen it once was to know and recognize it forever. The spell of Swinney's memories was broken when the Countess Amelie spoke softly at his side. Curiously, she used almost the same words that had come to Swinney at his first sight of the masterpiece.
"How it lives!"
And then she added,
"What would one not give to possess such beauty?"
A kind of bitter wave shook Mr. Swinney at the sound of the word possess. Possess. To possess, the Germans had charred, blackened, and defiled the neighbor nations of Europe. The guests had been filing into the massive library. They formed into their careful patterns, the Germans grouped in the far corner beneath the 15th-century Flemish tapestry, whose warm reds and blues set off the pasty white of their faces, which were beginning to show signs of strain. The correct, tawny Baron von Schleuder was pale, too. He kept licking his lips, affixing and removing his monocle, and staring at the picture. The British shifted their island close to the massive carved Spanish table and whispered amongst themselves. The French and Italians gesticulated and made approving noises. The Argentines formed a group close to the picture itself, with the suave, grey, icily cold Dr. Caldariega, de Paraná, flushed and excited, and Chester Allen Buskirk polishing his glasses briskly as a nucleus. Mr. Swinney felt the tension that lay beneath the exclamations and the high-pitched conversations in the room and understood it. His own mathematics were complete. The sum of 2 and 2 still made 4. The trial balloon was about to go up. He said to himself, "Clever Caldariega. He'll help them get rid of their loot, but he doesn't trust his dear Nazi friends any farther than he can see them." Mr. Chester Allen Buskirk, having wiped the last speck off the windows of his lenses, adjusted his pince-nez, cleared his throat, and stepped toward the painting which hung just above eye level. An uneasy hush, broken only by whisperings, fell over the room. Buskirk took full advantage of the center of the stage. He cocked his head gingerly, he stepped away, he stepped closer to examine the texture of the painting. He stepped away again.
"God," thought Swinney, "you've got it in your hands, little man. Tell them it's a fake and you'll spike them. Surely you know who owns that picture."
Buskirk cleared his throat again, removed his pince-nez, and turned to de Paraná and Caldariega.
"Unquestionably authentic. Unquestionably Rembrandt's Old Woman of Harlem."
The German group stirred first, shifting and turning. Several of them used their handkerchiefs. Baron von Schleuder gazed sternly and fixedly at the picture and said,
"Colossal."
French and Italian shoulders were lifted higher, and Argentines broke into a torrent of excited Spanish, and the cynical whisperings of the British increased. The Russians glowered. There were no other Americans in the room besides Mr. Swinney and Buskirk. The fussy, self-important little art expert was perfectly conscious of the figure he was cutting. He drifted over toward Mr. Swinney, attracted by the light from the tower of the Countess Amelie's bronze-colored hair. The Countess turned her wide-set huntress's eyes on the little man and said,
"What learning was embodied in that simple statement?"
Buskirk preened himself.
"Learning? No, it was an emotion. Learning may be prey to error. The emotions aroused by the perfect blending of intellect with light and color, never."
"Damn your emotion," said Mr. Augustus A. Swinney sharply.
Buskirk started so that his pince-nez fell into his hand.
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
Mr. Swinney's voice was cold and cutting.
"There is also such a thing as ethics."
Buskirk was confused, but with the slyly feline eyes of the girl moving from him to Swinney and back again, he retreated behind an epigram.
"Art is not concerned with ethics, but with truth."
"Bunk," said Mr. Swinney, his voice made harsh by his rising anger. "You know to whom that picture belongs, and God knows where he is or what the Germans did to him. And yet, knowing it, you identified the picture for a pack of Nazi thieves in cutaway coats."
Buskirk became thoroughly flustered under the attack. Heat rising to his face fogged his glasses, and he fell to polishing them furiously.
"I am acquainted with Van Schuven. He is now in New York. He may have sold the picture."
"Did you inquire?"
Buskirk felt that he was being interrogated like a little boy and was being humiliated before the stunning and dramatic-looking Countess, who was now watching only Mr. Swinney with a curious expression at the corners of her full mouth. He drew himself up and attempted extrication.
That is none of my concern, sir. There is an American branch of the International Art Salvage Commission to which Van Shuven can turn to press a claim. I do not deal with property rights, but with the limitless horizons of eternal art.
He stole a quick look at the Countess Amelie and thought he detected a flicker of approval in her face and felt encouraged to continue.
Truth in art is not a matter of a bill of sale, sir. The fruits.
Hush, said Mr. Swinney curtly, the way one might have spoken to a child, but there was distaste on his lips. He looked down at Buskirk from his lean, clean height.
You are a living, walking, talking anachronism. You are as bad as they. You condone. It is time the world learned a better truth than yours, that nothing matters but the difference between right and wrong.
The Countess Amelie drew in a deep breath and veiled her eyes with her coal darkened lids. Buskirk blustered.
You are insulting, sir. I am here as the guest of a government official.
That's just it, said Mr. Swinney,
but he said it to the retreating, outraged back of the little art expert.
You have hurt his feelings, said the Countess.
Damn and hell, said Mr. Swinney from the depths of his growing anger. It is sickening.
He stopped speaking, and the Countess turned her enveloping gaze on him interrogatively to see whether he would continue and tell what was sickening. Mr. Swinney did not do so. His thin lips closed, and his indignant eyes roved over the room and the restless group of people. But he knew quite everything. The pattern was clear, unmistakable, and mathematically logical. But it was the perverted, graceless mathematics of the most evil men the world had ever known. For 3 years the Germans had been looting captured Europe of its art treasures, over and beyond what the Gorings and von Ribbentrops had pilfered for themselves and their estates, millions upon millions of dollars worth of world-famous and historic paintings, sculptures, and antiquities had been pouring into Munich from gutted museums of Poland, Holland, France, Belgium, Italy, Czechoslovakia, Russia, and Norway, from galleries and private collections stripped bare, from ransacked homes. Mr. Swinney knew that in every occupied city, Quislings had waited with lists prepared of every art object of value in the vicinity. Like locusts, the Gestapo and party boys had descended upon the communities with vans and trucks and carted it away. Germany might be losing the war in the military sense, but her thieves had cornered the art market of the world. Now the discredited and bankrupt party heelers were preparing to fence the swag for the dollar credits needed to bolster their collapsing financial bastions. The German mind was no mystery to Mr. Swinney, who had traveled among them and done business with them. Crude and brash though their methods were, they knew they needed a sponsor for their transactions at least once removed from their persons, some group to act at once as window dressing, front, and buffer, and raise some slight incense smoke screen of legitimacy to offset the stench of intrinsic German crookedness. What was more logical than to turn to the strongest and wealthiest and most powerful South American nation, the only one whose government was openly friendly and helpful to the Nazis and secretly hostile to the United States and the Allies. Even Mr. Swinney had to admit that the use of the name Dr. José Calderiega as sponsor of the exhibition had been brilliantly conceived. For if this show was not exactly a government affair, yet Dr. Calderiega was of the government, as sub-minister of culture. The Germans had calculated well that his name and position would stifle criticism and opposition from the outset. The use of Alfonso de Paraná had been clever, too. Known as one of the wealthiest men in the country and connoisseur of art in his own right, with a notable private collection, the turning up of a famous picture in his possession was just the right touch. But Mr. Swinney had no illusions about de Paraná. He was an out-and-out fascist and Germanophile. Enough of the booty would stick to his fingers to make it worth his while, but his role was strictly that of a middleman. Mr. Swinney thought with disgust of the greed that would bring art dealers through the salons in the days to come, perhaps some of his own countrymen among them. Nor did Mr. Swinney need the rumors or pickups or snatches of conversation caught on the fly to tell him how the stuff was to get there. Light, small, compact, a rolled-up canvas by Raphael would fit into any cranny in an undersea boat. A 12th-century triptych, a medallion by Benvenuto Cellini, a tapestry by Gobelin, ancient jeweled candlesticks from Polish churches, encrusted chalices of the early popes would take up little more space. One U-boat could load enough boodle to pay for a day of war. Mr. Swinney had no doubt that a Nazi submarine was lurking somewhere nearby, waiting to unload the rest of its cargo if it had not already done so. Once they had got away with the transfer and sale of the Rembrandt as a trial, the Nazis would flood the market for all the traffic would bear. It all dovetailed, even to that pompous ass Buskirk. Fascists or no fascists, Calderiega and De Paraná were no fools. They knew their Germans and had cleverly protected themselves against having a fake put over on them. But in addition, Buskirk's presence had served to set a further seal upon the affair. A kind of silence fell over the room again, and Mr. Swinney saw that the icily gray Dr. Calderiega was about to say a few words. They came out in Spanish, as neat and clipped as his gray mustache, as tight and spare and reserved as his figure.
"Presence of this great painting, under the roof of Señor de Paraná, milestone in and monument to Latin American culture. Congratulations do this great art patron of Buenos Aires."
The Germans nudged one another, smirked, raised their champagne glasses as in a military drill, and said,
"Hoch!"
A few desultory hear-hears came from the British contingent. A Frenchman cried,
"Épatante!"
The Russians glowered silently and shifted their feet uncomfortably. People in the room milled about a little. Mr. Swinney's gorge rose.
"Fire and damnation," he thought to himself. "Not only I know, they all know. Every one of them. Everyone here knows, and the Germans and that gray Argentine and the fat one with the pouches know they know, and are ramming it down their throats."
This, then, was the second lie that was being circulated there that afternoon, as lightly as the canapés and the Venetian cocktail glasses, as hushed and hidden as that other diplomatic fiction of the non-presence of diplomats of countries engaged in war. The British knew. It was in their tight lips and frigid bearing. The Russians knew, and showed it in their scowls and uneasily moving feet. The Swiss, the Slavs, the French, the Italians knew it. The Spaniards were laughing up their sleeves. The fashionably gowned women knew it, and showed it in the sly casting of their eyes and heads bent forward to whisper. The men from the embassies had known it for weeks and merely moved a little more stiffly from the hips. Everyone was privy to the same logic, the same reasoning, the same rumors, the same information as Mr. Augustus A. Swinney, simple, loyal American citizen, refrigeration engineer, and fascist hater. But no one said anything. Over them all, like an unseen, viscous garment, constricting and attenuating thought and movement and behavior, lay the cloak of diplomatic conduct. The soft net of protocol was tougher than steel. They might know what they knew or whisper behind their hands what they pleased, but until something was said or done, the truth that they knew was not a truth at all, but a lie sealed in their bosoms. Cleverly, the net spun in the musty office of the Pinacotec had been cast the long way from Munich and ensnared them all. That is, with one notable and fatal exception— that exception being the curious mathematical mind of Mr. Swinney, who lived by the addition of 2 and 2. Alfonso de Paraná was replying to the speech of the sub-minister of culture, his voice oily with success and content.
"Let us not say that I am to be congratulated, but rather Argentina, the country that is permitted to be the host to such a peerless work of art, is fortunate indeed. I am proud."
Between the end of the speech, the polite murmurs of applause, the reiterated "Och!" of the Nazis, and what Mr. Swinney said and did, no more than a second or two elapsed. But in that brief interim in which his limbs were chill with rage, his mind leaped back to a tale he remembered reading as a boy. The story of the king's new suit of clothes, in which the three rascally tailors clad the king with imaginary thread and fabric, and none in the sycophant court dared contradict that the non-existent garment was not as beautiful as they claimed it to be. He remembered even, as sharply as though it had been thrown up on a screen before him, the illustration of the king walking through the streets, mother naked, past the cheering throngs lined up to view his fine new suit, the train-bearer behind holding up the ends of the non-existent cloak. And he remembered the little child in the throng at the curb who looked up and cried,
"But the king hasn't any clothes on."